Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 98, section 3, which is old single column page 1080. All right, so last week, recall that as we got into the Occident here, step one was what played out in Greece. Obviously, what you start in Greece rolls over to Rome. So that's where we go next. Remember that the main element that's being built up here that leads into Christianity is the mystery cults. And we were dabbling with the beginnings of that phenomenon in our discussion here when we're talking about Greece, and now we're ready to roll into what is more immediately, you know, what was influencing Christianity and those first 3 centuries after Christ. Remember that the key ingredient here, besides, you know, the attractiveness of mystery, you know, the whole mystery ritual stuff that they had in general, is Mother of God, the concept of the Mother of God. That's been hanging around in one form or another ever since Cain left the second garden. And those that stemmed from his influence fixated on Eve and, you know, lost total sight of Adam, since Adam was not Cain's father. And that just builds and builds and builds over time. Like we saw with all things, it becomes all the more elaborate, complicated, intense, whatnot. And it's reaching a crescendo here as we get it into Rome. And in those heights of its fervor is when it gets absorbed into Christianity. So it's a very powerful phenomenon, for no other reason, just because of how intense, how significant a phenomenon it was when Christianity was interacting with it. So, you know, not surprising that Christianity would have been highly influenced by it in many, many ways. So we'll see all that play out. Let's see, anything else that we need to say up front? I'll remind you how in that last paragraph of section 2, we saw them already hinting at that we're getting close to papers 99 to 103. And they start talking about religion in a threefold context with philosophy and science, and that philosophy is taking the lead in that discussion, so that what follows can be true religion and true science. And, papers 99 through 103 are not just about real religion, as opposed to all this kind of quote-unquote religion we've been reading about forever, what evolution produces. So it's not just about real religion, but it's about putting that real religion in that philosophic context so that it's true religion. And it's properly framed, not just properly initiated. Because you can initiate something wonderfully, but if you go forward with it falsely, it's, it doesn't take you very far. So that's, you know, it's very important that eventually mankind develops true religion. So there's going to be a lot of discussion about philosophy and how it sets that proper context. All right, but meanwhile, let's take a look at Rome, and you'll see we don't drop way back like we did with Greece. You know, remember where we were looking at basically the immediately relevant Andite or Aryan migration into Greece. Not long after Machiavelli and Melchizedek. But here, we're gonna, like I said, it's because it's really the phenomenon is, shifts from Greece to Rome. So we're down the road a ways as we start the story here with Rome.
Section 3, the Melchizedek teachings in Rome. Having grown out of the earlier religious forms of worship of the family gods into the tribal reverence for Mars, the god of war, it was natural that the later religion of the Latins was more of a political observance than were the intellectual systems of the Greeks and Brahmins or the more spiritual religions of several other peoples.
So a couple of things you see there. I mean, one, we're seeing again how different groups sort of focus most directly on a different facet of the bigger picture. And so, you can always think, well, yeah, it's limited in and of itself, but maybe down the road somewhere there'll be, all these different elements will come together and you'll actually build the whole elephant. Someone brings the trunk, someone brings the tail, etc. Right? So you see that there. You also see, a little reminder of, that when we talk about the evolution of civilization, of, how this progresses, very definitively, it's not just on this planet, but on every planet. You start out with families and clans, and and you notice that in that mode, like they're saying, you've got family gods, basically. Eventually, you've got to have some bigger concept to bring the clans together in a tribe. And with tribalism, much more definitively, you bring in that second indispensable of the early phase of the progression of civilization, war. Right? War is the indispensable key ingredient. Sort of animating tribalism, and then eventually, all good things taken to extreme become bad. What in the evolutionary process is very important there. Eventually, that the excesses become so significant that you start to actually think about leaving war behind. Right? So that one of the key things that drives going from tribe to nation is leaving war behind. But when you got that tribalism getting going, obviously the god of war, Mars, is going to be a very key concept, that people are exalting, and reverencing, like they're saying there. Right? You may speak of the veneration of the personification itself, Mars, but there is a literal reverence of war. You're using the sixth adjutant, right, to really identify with the concept of war, and you know, and find an outlet for your sense that there's something bigger than yourself going on with your life. All right, so all that's in play. All you know, they're reminding you of how we're stepping into the normal evolutionary process. Now, of course, you know, let's just take a second to, for an aside, the degree to which this book has any reason to be here, right? That there's an emergency in terms of civilization. Right? One of the things, you know, that ways that you can see that is, you know, the tenuous hold that mankind, the leading edge of mankind, has had for a while on going beyond tribe to nation and even to territorial state. And countries like the United States, you know, are almost singular in, you know, in really pushing that forward. You know, the degree to which that's evaporating, you know, and more tribalism is setting in. Sure, it may not be, you know, it may be a neo-tribalism, you might say, right? It's not necessarily going to be the old, you know, racial or ethnic sort of tribalism. I mean, you know, that'll play out too, naturally. But you know, the more and more that people break up into what are effectively tribes, and, you know, in recent years, more and more people reverence that concept and speak delightfully, joyfully about how they've started a tribe on the internet, and right, and join the tribe. And see, the ignorance of that, you know, because in one breath they'll, you know, they'll say they're ultra Pacific people, right? It's like, yeah, but you're fostering tribes, which means you're going to get war again, right? Because that's innate in tribes. There is no such thing as tribes without war. It'll split nations in apart in civil wars, or what have you. There's always that. You can always pause to reflect when they remind you of the natural progressive evolutionary sequence. It's like, oh, wait a minute, I see retrogression, not progression. You know, and you don't just retrogress in part; you get the whole package. So, all the delights, quote unquote, of what it took for Western civilization to push out of tribalism, like, you know, how many hundreds of thousands, millions of people had to be slaughtered in England to get from tribe to nation, right? And they're barely there right now, right? I mean, they still kind of think of themselves as tribes. I mean, that's why they have to have a parliamentary government, right? Because they aren't really a nation, you know, fully, right? And that you need a parliamentary system if you're going to have any kind of sort of democracy when you still really fundamentally have tribes. It's so tenuous, and yet it was so costly just to get to the beginning tentative stages. And, the fact that we're willfully going backwards, you know, is profoundly ignorant and very sad. Okay, but I digress. Let's get back to the Latins. So, notice that they don't, like I said, didn't take us way back into the second millennium BC here in any detail like they did with the Greeks. Here we're basically going to just step into the 6th century BC. Right? That pivotal century when everything gets animated. Like we saw with the Greeks, and they want to say, okay, when things were getting animated with the Greeks, and we were getting, you know, the philosophic awakening there, that can contribute to future civilization governmental, you know, democracy, you know, all of those philosophic things and that spiritual quickening in the 6th century that are awakening there in Greece, going to roll over into Rome and into amongst the Latin tribes, and you know, what do they do with it? What do they contribute to that process? So let's see what they tell us about that here.
In the great monotheistic renaissance of Melchizedek's gospel during the 6th century before Christ, too few of the Salem missionaries penetrated Italy. and those who did were unable to overcome the influence of the rapidly spreading Etruscan priesthood with its new galaxy of gods and temples, all of which became organized into the Roman state religion. This religion of the Latin tribes was not trivial and venal like that of the Greeks. Neither was it austere and tyrannical like that of the Hebrews. It consisted, for the most part, in the observance of mere forms, vows, and taboos.
Okay, so here we go again, yet another priesthood. You know, as we've seen so many times, and you know, why do we keep seeing this as we're talking about the Melchizedek missionaries or the spiritual quickening in the 6th century BC? Because what was very important and necessary way back in the evolution of religion, right? You can't get forward except through priesthood. Every world goes through that process. But they mention it, keep mentioning it, because all good things are being taken to an extreme and becoming bad, and that thing in particular, right? You're starting to overplay it, and you're seeing it over and over again. The fact that that won't let itself evolve forward, it won't see itself as a stepping stone, the priesthood, it severely has been hampering throughout all, of the old world, the Melchizedek missionaries. We're trying to foster a little bit of progressive consciousness one way or another, no matter how, how much Melchizedek's teachings get reworked as the Melchizedek missionaries leave, get farther and farther from Palestine. But nonetheless, right, there's an effort to try to push things forward a little bit, and the priesthood is just a giant boat anchor over and over and over again. Here, it's kind of a little bit of a different thing. This is a priesthood that's found a whole new animism because of the spiritual quickening in the 6th century BC. What really gets what eventually becomes the Roman Empire going, right, starts with Etruscan civilization, and it sort of morphs over and, starts, to the north of Rome, in other words, but eventually, Rome becomes the dominant phenomenon and it evolves into a Roman civilization, but it's all getting started here with the Etruscans, and you see yet again, just like we saw back with the Greeks. Let's see, where was that when they were commenting on that? Right at the very beginning of section one. The Salem missionaries might have built up a great religious structure among the Greeks had it not been for their strict interpretation of their oath of ordination, a pledge imposed by Machaventa, which forbade the organization of exclusive congregations for worship, and which exacted the promise of each teacher never to function as a priest, never to receive fees for religious service, only food, clothing, and shelter. And they brought that up because you're going, well, wait a minute, isn't that a good thing? It's like, no. See, they were pointing out that the Melchizedek missionaries were actually not being properly evolutionary enough, playing that too hard, driving forward from priesthood. In other words, the beginnings of Western civilization in Greece and Rome, the proper way to move it forward from where it was, you still needed the priesthood significantly. The degree to which the sort of necessary priesthood for Western civilization in its beginnings didn't actualize in Greece, coincidentally, there's an Etruscan priesthood that gets spun up with the spiritual quickening, has a lot of newfound energy, and is there to guarantee that what's going to be Christianity is going to start that way. See, so we'll talk about this quite a bit next time, and then lot as we get into papers 99 through 103, obviously. This is a big issue of, when is it time to move past that, and when is it all essential that you have that, because there's no other way for it to go forward except through that mechanism. And see, that's the thing that really strikes you relative to what they said in the Orient, India, China, whatnot. Here, they're really emphasizing that this was a necessary evil, quote unquote, if you will, right? Kind of the way they talk about the priesthood way back in the Evolution of Religion papers. So we don't want to be too hard on Christianity, getting all kind of balled up with a priesthood to begin with. They're kind of telling you between the lines here that, no, that's the way it needed to go. And the evolutionary process would not be thwarted here. If it couldn't make it happen through Greece, it's going to make it happen in the predicate to Rome. And it's going to be there. Right? The God of evolution won't be mocked any more than the Universal Father. Right? You're not going to get around what's necessary. So, but then, right, then the question is, well, how long is it necessary? At what point, did we start to get to where we needed to leave that priesthood behind? Yeah. When did it start to become a boat anchor for the the evolution of what went forward from Jesus? All right, so back to the content here. So they've see with their new galaxy of gods and temples. You can see new galaxy. In other words, the Greek gods are. This is when they're really kind of definitively moving over. Over there. It's in the context of the Etruscans. So you're going to have a Roman flavor for all the different Greek gods. Like I was saying, became organized into the Roman state religion. Now notice, that, they're making a point of emphasizing how limited in many ways this phenomenon is, right? It's just, for the most part, in observance of mere forms, vows, and taboos. It's like, well, okay, so it's not very much. But, like they said with the Greeks, right, it's not, at least it wasn't, trivial and venal like that of the Greeks. Right? Venal, in other words, the favor of the gods is for sale. Right? Wait a minute. When the coin in the coffer rings, your soul from purgatory springs. Yeah, like that. Yeah, right. Where the favor of the gods is for sale. Martin Luther got all upset about that. That venal behavior. As limited and kind of priest-ridden and just, ritual and whatnot. Okay, but it is, if you're going to go forward from the Greeks, that little step is a step forward, right? Get some rudimentary ritual and taboos and stuff going. Okay. Whereas the Greeks, in so many ways, the reason they went so far with philosophy is they totally, shoved all that stuff aside and have taboo boat anchors, holding them back and things. So it was great. It was great for them. But if you get back to the religion thing, right? So we get philosophy, but we got to have religion, too. And so you need that. And the Romans are going to contribute to that process of moving that forward. But they're going to need, obviously, some greater sophistication of ritual and stuff. This is kind of a real primitive form. Oh, yeah, the mystery cult. Yes. That's where they're going to get all of that complexity from, right?
Well, forms, vows, and taboos makes up a large part of what passes for religion today.
Yeah.
And it's not.
Of course. Right. Not to mention, in the first sentence there, this section when he said, having grown out of the early religious forms of worship, again, that's quote-unquote worship, of course, right? Like, we're still trying to get to the point where we're going to have any sort of a serious discussion about genuine worship, right? We're a million years down the road with humanity, and, every time we use the word worship, it's in quotes, right? I mean, as it still is today, right? It's... because you're still thinking of it as some sort of an outer life ritual, forms, whatnot, phenomenon, right? Something that is your predicate relationship to the cosmos at the ceiling of your inner life, right? I mean, you know, so when they say worship, you know, remember, and all these things, you know, the origins of worship paper, you know, and everywhere up to here, right, you know, just remember it's, you know, it's reverence, it's, you know, veneration, you know, it's just basic sixth adjutant, you know, and not even really sixth adjutant as the spirit of worship, right? It's just the energy phenomenon of the sixth adjutant in those beginning phases, you know, which not only gives you zeal, so that you have the fervor, but, you know, gives you that feeling and the level of the feelings that we call reverence, right? So that you can reverence something. You know, and first you reverence rocks and hills, and, you know, like we've talked about, right? And eventually when you start reverencing humans, then it's kind of more, you know, you can say you're actually venerating that human, you know, or that anthropomorphic God. But, you know, that's what we really mean, you know, we'll see if we can talk about the real stuff when we get to real religion in papers 99 through 103. All right, anything else there? Don't forget that you also have the contrast with the austere and the tyrannical, like that of the Hebrews.
1,000 foreskins.
Right, so, you know, kind of staking some ground in, you know, in between the trivial and the venal and the austere and the tyrannical. So, it's in an evolutionary sense, they're offering something. You know, the Etruscans and rolling into the Romans are contributing to this process in a helpful way. All right.
Roman religion was greatly influenced by extensive cultural importations from Greece. Eventually, most of the Olympian gods were transplanted and incorporated into the Latin pantheon. The Greeks long worshipped the fire of the family hearth. Hestia was the virgin goddess of the hearth. Vesta was the Roman goddess of the home. Zeus became Jupiter, Aphrodite, Venus, and so on down through the many Olympian deities.
Yeah, so just like they were mentioning, and, you know, let's, you know, notice that, you know, they told you you're starting with the family stuff. So obviously, the goddess of the hearth would be a very foundational element in that, you know, in that process of importing those gods. Start with what you definitely have coming out of the family gods. So you have the goddess of the hearth, building from there, and you're going. You know, you have once again that key concept that. Anywhere that the Andite migrations went, there's always a possibility for Melchizedek missionaries or, you know, like, you know, inner recognition to play off of the Sky Father. Right? So, you know, we had Zeus, and Zeus Pater, you know, the Sky Father there in Greece. It rolls over. And notice just the very fact that, you know, there was a strong tendency for the Latins to not just go with Jove, kind of more, you know, directly just the sky of Zeus, right? But to have a name that incorporates the father part directly into it, and not something that you can add or not add, you know, like saying Zeus Pater. You know, like saying Dios Pater, right? Right, Jupiter, right? The Pater is father, right? It's Jove Pater, right? So that, you know, just the fact that you've got Jupiter, you know, is helping you to eventually say, you know, you've been talking about father for a long time, God as a father. Are you interested in the real God the Father? You know, and the same is true today, right? I mean, lots of people give voice to God as a father, right? But what does it tell you in the very first paragraph of the Urantia book? Okay, your ideas attached to this verbiage, you know, that you use of God the Father are really pitiful, right? Your ideas are needed some serious improvement. Your ideas are primitive or worse. At best, Right? And but at least, you know, there's that. So if you can get over people's preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices about the word father, be it religious or otherwise, right? At least the word's there, you know, that you can say, you know, or Jesus could say, that father thing. Would you like to know more about father? Let me tell you about the real father. Not the anthropomorphic, you know, childish God the Father, the real God the Father, that is not at all what you've ever thought. Right? What you try to get your mind wrapped around in the first five papers of the Urantia book. Right? Something really different. Anyway, I digress again. But just notice, I mean, you know, we're looking for the little things and going from Greece to Rome, you know, and just going not just from Zeus to Jove, but from Zeus to Jupiter is an encouraging sign. Right? Whether it actually goes anywhere or not, who knows, right? But it's something maybe that recognition could play off of. All right, and then the other little thing there is, you know, we talked about this before. Notice Olympian deities. Instead of gods, they're saying deities, and of course it's lowercase d, because we're not talking about, you know, real deity stuff, okay, here. But you know, why do they do that again? Remember why they do that? Why they refer to them as Olympian deities in contrast to Olympian gods? Because fundamentally there's some concept, like the hearth, or war, or whatever. Right? There's a concept that's being personified as a god, right? Now, and there's a little measure of validity, you know, if you set the personalization aside and you just think about the concept, you know, that's not utterly unlike, right, what you're thinking about when you're talking about capital D deity, you know, this functioning stuff, this fundamental quality is unity, you know, that gets personalized as capital G God. God is personalized deity, right? See, so, you know, there's the budding, you know, recognition of that two-step process to get to God, right? That there's something antecedent to God, you know, but instead of it being a bottom-up antecedent, you know, where you've got like the hearth and you're exalting up to some personification, right? The challenge to get to the capital G God is to go all the way above capital G God to capital D deity, right, and go down, right, to discover God from the top down, so that he's absolutely not any sort of an anthropomorphic magic man anymore, right, to discover his deity predicate, and all the other deity predicates, some of which are personalized and some of which aren't, right? Some stay transcendent to all the personalizations, like the Paradise Trinity. All right, so that, you know, it's always great, you know, when you want to challenge yourself to kind of push your relationship to the revelations forward a little bit out of the old wineskins, you know, notice those little things, because those little things are key. There's nothing arbitrary about anything they do like that. Why did they say deity, and why is it lowercase d, and all that? You know, figure that out. All right?
The religious initiation of Roman youths was the occasion of their solemn consecration to the service of the state. Oaths and admissions to citizenship were in reality religious ceremonies. The Latin peoples maintained temples, altars, and shrines, and in a crisis would consult the oracles. They preserved the bones of heroes, and later on, those of the Christian saints.
Yep. So already we're seeing, yeah, right. I mean, you know, this is what it's going to be. Everything we're going to read is just, you know, where did Christianity get that? I mean, and so, you know, when all is said and done, it's like, so there really isn't really anything original in Christianity except the word Jesus, right? Yeah, everything else is just, right, something that was there before. But that's the way evolutionary religion is, right? As we talked about so many times. I mean, things get invented, and they never go away. They just get morphed forward. re-rationalized, whatnot. But the basic elements, you know, stay forever, because that's the problem. You know, you've got this false existentialization of all your ideas that you're calling religion, right? And it's very difficult to de-existentialize these things that you've got in your head and see them as just evolutionary elements, you know, stepping stones that, you know, need to be left behind eventually, like priesthoods.
Do you see this as part of the tribalistic backslide that we're going through as well?
Again, you know, the more you appreciate all the different facets of tribalism, the more you can go, oh, we've got that one, we've got that one, we've got that one. Yeah, right.
It's like even through media, even through media and TV, you can see the same rehashing of these same rituals and concepts.
Yeah, everything, you know, becomes very ritualistic. Thought becomes ritualistic, you know, et cetera. You know, and you start to have, you know, people clamoring for thought crimes, you know, because you aren't following the precise sort of Pharisaic precision of thought and all this sort of stuff, right? All that's happening. It's all an ominous sign,
yeah.
Right? You know, and it's not just tribalism. You can kind of be even more specific now that we're talking about Rome. Right? The more you know about what brought Rome down, right? You know, go through the list, the latter part of the book. It's like, yeah, we got a check mark in front of every one of those. Yeah. I wonder if history will repeat itself. Right? Yeah, it will. Unless mankind chooses otherwise, because if we don't, because you know we're at the point now where you really can't progress any further in spite of yourself. Right? You have to start choosing to be progressible any further. Right? And no one's choosing. It's sad to record so few persons. Right? Everyone is just kind of going with what comes naturally. Well, nothing further down the road is going to come naturally. Right? And so if we don't, you know, start choosing much more unnatural states of mind, we're not going to go forward. We're going to fall back. You're going to have that interregnum, like paper 118 tells you. And it's going to be a long time, right? evolution to accomplish what that inner recognition of revelation failed to accomplish. Right? And you know, they gave us this book, not to guarantee that it goes forward, but to guarantee that you have what you need if you want to choose to go forward. Otherwise, you know, a fear and hunger will be just as effective as your revelation in clearing your head of all your foolish ideological thoughts, right, that you're so existentially absolutely certain about right now. Fear and hunger will erase all that crap, right, and we'll start over again, and evolution will finally, you know, get it back. And, you know, you can only hope that maybe someone will remember that it's not wise to let the sharp sticks of evolution prod you forward. You might want to choose instead. It's a lot less prickly. Okay, so yeah, notice what they're saying there about this, you know, as I think everyone kind of knows, the Romans are trying to push things forward, beyond tribe into nation and even state, you know, so much of our budding sense of statecraft, you know, is going to be developed there in the Roman Empire. And so you've got a lot of civic consciousness that's sort of being religiousized by the sixth adjutant. Right? You know, like they're saying, the religious initiation of Roman youths was the occasion of their solemn consecration to the service of the state. Right? It's a solemn consecration, right? There's reverence, right? There's a sixth adjutant, right? In its initial form. That's a different flavor to bring in a lot of a fundamentally a secular sort of conception into the so-called religious scheme. Yeah, so that's going to definitely modify what the Hebrews are going to to offer to budding Christianity, and you know what the Zoroastrians are going to offer to budding Christianity, etc. There's going to be a reverence for civilization, specifically in its governmental expression, right, that isn't going to come from the other places. And it needs to be there. If you're going to get to true religion, you have to have the full package. Right? You have to have all the elements within that sphere of truth, not just religion. Everything else has got to be in there with it. That's what makes any one of the elements true, because they're all within a common sphere of truth. No element is out there in a sphere of falsehood. Yeah. Right? So it's important that all these different things find their way into the bigger the big picture conception that religion is going to be within. Right?
This formal and unemotional form of pseudo-religious patriotism was doomed to collapse, even as the highly intellectual and artistic worship of the Greeks had gone down before the fervid and deeply emotional worship of the mystery cults. The greatest of these devastating cults was the mystery religion of the Mother of God sect, which had its headquarters in those days on the exact site of the present church of St. Peter's in Rome.
Speaking of bones.
Right, and we'll get to that a little bit later here tonight. Talking about St. Peter's there again. Okay, so notice what the issue is, the double-edged sword. Okay, it's wonderful to have something to fire up the sixth adjutant, relative to. Okay, but you need a bridle for that baby. It's very energetic. It's orders of magnitude more energetic than the fifth adjutant. You can have a full five adjutant animal. Okay, and it doesn't immediately become more problem than help to the world. Right. There are no stable, only six adjutant creatures, right? Because that's an unstable state. Right. You need to bring in the seventh adjutant to put a governor, bridle, if nothing else, on the sixth adjutant, so you can pull back on the reins of the thing. Not to mention, as a philosophic impulse, the seventh adjutant sparking you to try to find a context to put it in. So you fire up the sixth adjutant, and it's not being governed. It's actually just looking for how can I take this even farther horizontally? Is there a 12 on my dial? Right, and so fervid, and deeply emotional on the level of feelings, instead of going up to the third level of meaning with the seventh adjutant, you just go horizontally on the level of feelings with the sixth adjutant, until you're searching for the remote recesses of insanity, right, on that level of the feelings. Okay. Not just fervent, fervid, right, not just boiling, but full-on crazy roiling, spattering all over the place, boiling, right? So that lack of a way to get control of this energy that you've unleashed, right? Just tears apart both societies, And once you have the dawning of the sixth adjutant in its collective mode in the middle of the 20th century, like we've talked about a lot of times, right? Again, you have this unbridled restlessness that injects into everything. Right? It's not just a few individuals and everyone kind of gets drugged along by them. No, I mean, everyone kind of has this in the air they're breathing. And it's just this ripping apart everything. Everything gets turned into an ideology. The application of the sixth adjutant, unfortunately, to an idea, making it an ideology, instead of applying that zeal to ideals, right, which is fine, sell us for you know, that eternal ideal. But the moment you're zealous for a temporal ideal, right, everything is going to start unraveling. And, yeah, so you've got to see that also in play right now, kind of inescapably, because of the way mind has been evolving over the last few centuries. Right, it's just, you know, we seriously, you know, either need to get a handle on ourselves or have to hope that, you know, there's kind of a collective system, so the seventh adjutant dawning in the collective in the not-too-distant future, okay? Sometime in this century, right? Before everything is just torn apart. Right? Yeah, all of that wonderful social reformation movements, you know, that started in the middle of the 19th century and were going forward into the 20th, first half of the 20th century, all of the leaders of those movements, you know, all wondered what the hell happened in the middle of the 20th century. You know, it seemed like all that fifth adjutant social impulse was going to lead to wonderful, you know, light and life on the planet. And all of a sudden, everything went all squirrely, right? And no one's been able to get it back in the bottle again. Right? Every organization that starts up with all sorts of great kind of social ideas is immediately torn asunder by all sorts of, you know, eating themselves introspective usage of the sixth adjutant, its energy, not as the spirit of worship, but just the energy of zeal, right, of the sixth adjutant, tearing every institution apart. Yeah. When you read about the Romans, right? I mean, you know, you're just endlessly going, "Oh yeah, that reminds me of today. Oh yeah, that's an issue." Mm-hmm. Right. It's very, very relevant. we could all get, you know, as you go back into tribalism, don't be surprised if you start to develop all sorts of fervid and deeply emotional, right, grotto exercises again. Okay. Grotto exercises. All right, so that's where we are.
Just add a volcano.
What else do they tell us here?
The emerging Roman state conquered politically, but was in turn conquered by the cults, rituals, mysteries, and god concepts of Egypt, Greece, and the Levant. These imported cults continued to flourish throughout the Roman state up to the time of Augustus, who, purely for political and civic reasons, made a heroic and somewhat successful effort to destroy the mysteries and revive the older political religion.
Okay, so now this is an interesting thing to think about. I think probably everyone is aware, you know, where does Jesus fit into Augustus's reign? Smack in the middle of it, right? I mean, Augustus reigned the 20 years before Jesus was born and the 20 years after Jesus was born. He's smack in the middle of it, okay? And remember what they tell you. There was a little mini spiritual quickening at the time of Jesus. There was a potential for a little bit of clarifying awakening going on. That's why, you know, despite all their issues, the followers of Jesus had the success they did going forward. That is because it was a fertile time. You know, well, it's a lot harder now than it was back then. Right? It was in the water. There was that little mini spiritual quickening, like they tell you. You know, that Jesus' incarnation was timed into. So, you know, you're going to see this in other ways. Literally right in the middle, right, of Augustus's reign is where Jesus is plopped. So, you know, Augustus's reign is going to encompass the times of that mini spiritual quickening. It can give Augustus a little bit more animated sense about things. He can see more clearly how problematic these mystery cults are long term for any sort of civilization. We're just going to eat ourselves alive with this. We're going to tear ourselves apart with this craziness. And so he can make an effort to try to clarify things. So, you know, it's not just someone that's going to hear the words of Jesus and go, "Oh, that sounds interesting." And it has a lot of different manifestations when you get these spiritual quickenings. Just like with Greece, you know, it gave you the beginning of philosophy, right, as opposed to you know, what it did in India, or it gave you some religions. Okay, you know, it gives you something in the upper domain, something predicated on your encirclement in the Holy Spirit, something predicated on the three cosmic intuitions. Right? You know, it may not just be, your spiritual insight, the third cosmic intuition, right, that really gets the emphasis. It might be one of the other ones, like the first cosmic intuition. Or it might be a little bit more of a balanced of all three, right? But it's a spiritual quickening, a holy spirit, not a partly spirit spiritual quickening, a holy spirit spiritual quickening. And so you can be very suspicious, see, that's not a coincidence that Augustus is... I mean, Augustus had a lot of clarity. Augustus had to clear up the calendar.
I thought Tiberius was ahead of Rome when Jesus went there.
Well...
When he was born, though. What? It was Augustus.
When he was born, it was Augustus.
Oh, I thought you said Augustus was through this whole... He was in the middle of Augustus.
I mean, he was his birth. Jesus was born, right? Right in the middle of Augustus' reign.
I see.
Augustus reigned until AD 14.
I misunderstood.
Like I was saying about Augustus, I mean, there's a lot of things. We'll talk a little bit more about him. But just to appreciate how he might be benefiting from this little bit of a quickening, for good or for ill, right? Some of the things kind of go off the rails. When Julius Caesar instituted the Julian calendar, what we call the Julian calendar, did the calendar reform, he died... was killed almost immediately after he did that, and so he didn't get to oversee the first leap year. And because everyone liked to think in terms of inclusive counting, right? And they weren't doing the leap years properly, right? They weren't doing them every 4 years; they were doing them every fourth year. So, in very short order, the vernal equinox is getting way off whack again. Right? And Augustus notices that and says, okay, wait, stop everything. Okay, we've got to skip a bunch of leap years for a number of years and get it back square again. See, all kinds of things like that. Don't be surprised if Augustus has some objectivity and kind of is helping everyone get back on the rails again in certain ways. But it might also go to his head, which of course it did. Okay, But anyway, it's important to, when they say the time of Augustus, okay, that's the time of Jesus' birth, very precisely in the middle of it. So he was going to try to clear that up. But, it's an energy, maybe if he's super heavy-handed, as long as he's alive, but, the moment he's dead, everyone's going to want to go back. It's going to take some really significant evolutionary phenomenon to deal with the energy of the mystery cults. It's not going to be done by some fiat, heavy hand of an individual. It's just not going to solve the problem, no matter how much he's, deified and has absolute power and whatnot. Okay.
One of the priests of the state religion told Augustus of the earlier attempts of the Salem teachers to spread the doctrine of one God, a final deity presiding over all supernatural beings. And this idea took such a firm hold on the emperor that he built many temples, stocked them well with beautiful images, reorganized the state priesthood, reestablished the state religion, appointed himself acting high priest of all, and, as emperor, did not hesitate to proclaim himself the supreme God.
See, so the Melchizedek teachings had that consequence. Okay? Isn't that an interesting little footnote to history? Okay? But see, again, why did they take such a firm hold? I say, see, he's feeling that spiritual quickening. He's a significant genetic individual. Okay, he's got some relationship to the upper domain. He's not just a fancy animal down in the lower domain. I mean, he's got some insight. Right? He's going to recognize something when he hears it. And they start talking about what the Salem missionaries are saying. He's going, yes. Right? But of course, he's got an agenda too. It's like, yeah, that's a great idea. We need to get everyone to worship the Supreme God. And oh, by the way, it's me. or maybe I should say, by Jove, it's me. Because, of course, that's exactly who he's going, you know, he's going to replace Jove as the, you know, head of the, you know, the henotheistic head of the pantheon. Right? The emperors are going to, you know, become the replacement, you know, for both the Jove part of Jupiter and the Pater part, the father part of Jupiter, right? He's going to be the father of the, you know, of the empire and everything. All that's going to be officially declared. Yeah, he takes over that role as, you know, as the elevated fact, the sky, you know, and the father fact. Right? That becomes the emperor. You know, and that plays all the way until the 4th century, you know, 4th century A.D., you know, when finally you leave that deification of the emperors behind and things transition into Christianity. But see, it all got started because Augustus wasn't dull of mind. He felt the spiritual quickening, and Salem teachers told him some interesting ideas. And he ran with them. Okay. So you have to just kind of marvel at the evolutionary process, how, you know, it's always working with stuff, and you know, it just keeps playing things forward. You know, in a greater sense, nothing that seems to be going backward really is, right? It's at best kind of just going sideways under the evolutionary influence. It's trying to find a way. Just like with the evolution of biology, it roams around and finally finds a way to go up, and suddenly you get a new species, right? But it's got to meander around in the plane for a while, right? Until it can find that access door that, you know, it can go up through. You know, and so you can see it at work here. It's working through Augustus in spite of himself, right? It's part of a process. You know, this all can play into why Christianity can take root, you know, despite its issues. All right?
This new religion of Augustus worship flourished and was observed throughout the empire during his lifetime, except in Palestine, the home of the Jews. And this era of the human gods continued until the official Roman cult had a roster of more than 20 self-elevated human deities, all claiming miraculous births and other superhuman attributes.
No way Jesus is going to be accepted as anything if he doesn't have a miraculous birth and other superhuman attributes. I mean, not only will the mystery cults kind of guarantee that, you know, as a prerequisite for acceptance, but, you know, emperor worship also makes it just a given. You're going to get that mythology centered, you know, wrapped around Jesus, because otherwise he won't be evolutionarily acceptable to anyone. Okay? I mean, no real significant person is born anyway except by virgin birth, period, end of story. Yeah, you know he's fake if he wasn't. Okay? That's just the way they thought.
It's kind of like the arrangement. It can't be real unless it came from somewhere else. Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of that similar concept.
Yeah, I remember.
And evolutionary. You know,
okay, go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, I meant from an evolutionary acceptance of something like this, you know, until you really get into it, you know, the first question everybody asks is what? Who wrote it?
Yeah.
Where did it come from?
Mm-hmm.
So why is it real?
Yeah.
A similar kind of thing. It has to have, you know, even talks about there is some mystery that needs to be cultivated to some degree. I'm not so sure about lying about how it got.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But yeah, there is the truth about it, which is just as mysterious.
Yeah, and like we've talked about off and on, you know, it's not like Jesus wasn't aware of these issues too. You know, he's a dispensational revelation. Right. You know, so he's trying to engage, you know, the main evolutionary stream. Unlike the Urantia book. I mean, he's trying to engage the main evolutionary stream. So, I mean, he has to be fully aware in crafting how he's going to approach this to all of the expectations in the main evolutionary stream.
On every planet.
Yeah, well, there's that. But just, you know, let's just focus on this planet for a moment. Right. I mean, so, you know, he knew that he needed to do certain things that, you know, it didn't matter in the big picture. Like, you know, he would not be accepted if he didn't have 12 apostles. You know, if he had 14, that would be proof that he wasn't a genuine, right, you know, person. You know, he tried to match up with a lot of these cultural expectations when it wasn't a big issue. And the degree to which he didn't do it himself, those who followed him, you know, remolded him until he fit all of the cultural expectations.
It's just kind of the way the rabbis did the same thing in the Hebrew world, yeah, when they were in exile.
Yeah.
Well, let's rewrite it to make it work so that...
so it's effective, yeah. Right, yeah. You know, some rubber can meet the road, right? And you're not just throwing things over people's heads, and it's like, well, you know, you can pat yourself on the back, you know, for your virtue signaling, but you're not going to be effective. Right? You got to meet people as they are, where they are. Right? So, Paul knew that. Right? That's why he was effective. Abner, not so much. Right? All right. Okay, yeah, so like I was saying, you know, all the way until the fourth century, you know, you're building up this this roster of self-elevated human deities. Until finally they let go of that. All right.
The last stand of the dwindling band of Salem believers was made by an earnest group of preachers, the Cynics, who exhorted the Romans to abandon their wild and senseless religious rituals and return to a form of worship embodying Melchizedek's gospel, as it had been modified and contaminated through contact with the philosophy of the Greeks. But the people at large rejected the Cynics. They preferred to plunge into the rituals of the mysteries, which not only offered hopes of personal salvation, but also gratified the desire for diversion, excitement, and entertainment.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Oh, so. Yeah, because, you know, you want to feel that zeal of that sixth adjutant, right? Right. So,
look at all the church services.
Hallelujah.
Dancing.
Right. If you're not feeling it, it's not real. Yeah, so, I mean, that's where the evolutionary process is. And so you get this little bit more, you know, reflective commentary from the Cynics, and it's like, well, yeah, whatever. I'll take my grotto orgies, thank you.
Yeah.
Right, the way the light, the torchlight plays off the cave wall, and you know, and it's like, yeah, right. It's all very exciting. But as we know, right, those Cynics did eventually contribute their part to, you know, giving Christianity some, you know, more meat on its bones. All right, yeah. So again, the Melchizedek missionaries, you know, efforts finding a way to get through, you know, to some degree. All right, and then of course the other key thing there, notice that they almost literally repeated what they reminded you of, that very important thing that we highlighted last week when you're talking about Greek philosophic thought. You know, when they said, but the average men of these times could not grasp, nor were they much interested in, the Greek philosophy of self-realization and an abstract, capital D, deity. You know, philosophic concept. They rather craved promises of salvation coupled with a personal God who could hear their prayers. Like I told you, yeah. Mark that in your book. Come back, keep reminding yourself that that's where you are naturally. That's what you have to challenge yourself to be more than just someone who craves promises of salvation coupled with a personal God who can hear your prayers. Right? Right? Where you're thinking of prayer as a material technique, God as a material technique, you know, you have fear of death, you want to be saved. I mean, all of that self-interested, material-oriented scheme, right, of evolutionary religion. To be able to take your salvation for granted, which matter, no matter how much atonement doctrine in Christianity might theologically say you're supposed to take it for granted, no one does. I mean, if religion is about salvation, then what's it about? It's not religion. I mean, again, because that's really all people have ever thought that religion was a magic material technique, with a material oriented God. And salvation. And it's like, no, it's none of that stuff. Right? Jesus said, he's not your material father. He's your spiritual father. There isn't one iota of material technique to him. For instance, because he doesn't even have an outside. Right? He has no relationship to time and space, let alone to your material issues. The real God engages you in the upper domain of your mind, right? The inner life, right? The spiritualized mind. Not, he certainly, isn't out there literally in the external world playing with molecules, and he's not even in your lower domain, your associating mechanism, that's in an interplay with those molecules, where your feelings are. That's not the real God. That's the evolutionary God notion. That's the ghost cult God. It's not the real God, right? And it's just very difficult to not only break from a million years of tradition that's always said that that's what God is, but forget about tradition. Just assume that you're the first person in existence, and there's no tradition that you have to deal with. You still innately, as an animal origin creature, naturally, that's what God means to you. Right? He doesn't, naturally, you don't have any interest in the real God. Right? Who cares about God if he doesn't have anything to do with my material life? I mean, what's the point? Right?
Except Chris, as usual, you know what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. He is aware of all the outer life issues and time and space through the delegation that he does. He's aware of it all.
Right.
And he has a relationship to it.
Right. He does indirectly. Yeah. See, and of course, that's why there isn't just like the first five papers. I mean, why do you have all those subsequent papers? Right. Because, if God doesn't directly, micromanage the molecules, you mean the molecules are unmanaged? No. Universe is mind made and personality managed. Okay, it's just not personally managed by him as a purely existential deity. Right? So you have to have this whole recognition of how God's love gets to you through material affairs. Right?
The whole thing. It's not that he micromanages it, but he's aware of it.
But it's managed. Right?
But he's aware of it.
And he's right. I mean, he's aware of, like they try to explain, it starts to get very abstract and difficult to think about, but how they explain in the first five papers, how he, even though he has no experiential nature, so he doesn't have any direct relationship to experiential reality, nonetheless, it's innately there in that that facet of his existential deity that is as close to the experiential as you can get without actually being experiential. That self-experiential deity aspect of his nature, right, sort of has all of the endless experiences of experiential reality eternalized within it from the beginning, right? He relates to it, transcendent of any linearity, right? He relates to it, not as a beginning, a middle, and an end, or just an end, or just a beginning. He relates it transcendent to all that. It's all he relates to it in this transcendent experiential way, if you will. As they try to explain to you, you go off on that tangent any further. But yeah, he has the ability to have a resonance with what we have, right? It's just that, if he played with it directly, then there wouldn't be any place for me to play. Right? As we talked about many times, if he poked his fingertip into experiential domain, he would suck it all up inside of him, and there wouldn't be any place for me to be. or a galaxy to be, right? You get the colossal error of capital P pantheism, right? You know, where everything is just thoughts in the Godhead. It's like, no. This stuff is outside, right? It's not inside of him. You know, and that, coming to terms with that, right? It feels scary when you take God out of the micromanagement role. A lot of people, that's how they get up in the morning. They think, well, you know, even though I'm really scared, I believe that God micromanages and saying it's all going to be okay, right? It's like, you know, so if you tell them no, it's like, you know, how do they not just go catatonic and panic, right? It's like, okay, there's God the Mother. And you know, is that overarching fact of the experiential domain. And there's a whole complex system coordinated under her overarching deity, you know, so that it's as if the oneness of one individual is keeping it all together just so, but it isn't literally, right? She sees to it that you can have all of this complexity, and coincidentally, quote unquote, it all works together. Because, you know, she puts the parts in a whole, and so the parts have no choice but to be subservient to the whole, right? And to be coordinated, to coincidentally work out in the end, no matter how wayward the part might seem in and of itself. And it's bounded. It can't go outside of the whole. Right? And so ultimately it conforms. The only way it doesn't ultimately conform is if it chooses to cease to be. Okay? And then it's not an issue. Right? You don't have to worry about nothing. Okay? So, you know, that all that I mean, that's the fifth epical revelation. It's a huge challenge. It's so far beyond where they were 2,000 years ago and where we still basically are, like they're just telling us there. Everyone is still, you know, in that old mode. I mean, Christians have the New Testament, but most of their thoughts are Old Testament. Yeah. As a Urantia book reader, are all of your thoughts still kind of Old Testament too? Right? I mean, just catch yourself, because see, that's the natural stuff. You know, you have to catch yourself thinking, it's like, well, I don't know, what do I have to do about my salvation thing? It's like, no, that was done. It's over. I mean, literally factualized over at Pentecost. There's no issue there anymore. Right? Yeah, but I see this one sentence in the book. It seems to tell me that I'm on a knife edge. Well, then you're misinterpreting that paragraph, because you know that's not the case. You're saved by grace. Everyone gets a thought adjuster by grace. No one is walking on the edge of the cliff in this life. You can take your salvation for granted. Okay, now what? Okay. You know, and if you can take your salvation for granted, what's the point of religion then? What do I need religion for? See, that's the first thing I gotta ask you. You do need religion, but not as a promise for fanciness in time. You need real religion. You need to be bound back to eternity at your nucleus, instead of what's been called religion, which is just a-ligion, to use Latin here, right? You're not bound back, you're bound to issues of time. People have a-ligion, not a religion. They're bound to time, temporal affairs. They're not bound back to eternity. That's why they can't fear not. You can't fear not until you're bound back to eternity first. As long as you're bound to time, fearing not is impossible. So you can't even do step one of what Jesus asked you to do, let alone getting into genuine love and service. I mean, you can't even fear not. All right. Meanwhile, back to the Romans. What else? Okay. So. So like that final paragraph there of section 3. Okay, so yeah, just reminding us. Remember how when you get to the part 4, they you know remind you about the influence of Epicureanism and Stoicism and Cynicism, you know, and sort of the non-influence of skepticism. Right, so, you know, the cynics come back around in the story up there. All right, let's get to the mystery cults proper here.
Section 4, the mystery cults. The majority of people in the Greco-Roman world, having lost their primitive family and state religions, and being unable or unwilling to grasp the meaning of Greek philosophy, turned their attention to the spectacular and emotional mystery cults from Egypt and the Levant. The common people craved promises of salvation, religious consolation for today, and assurance of hope for immortality after death.
So they repeated it a third time. Just to remind you. And notice they even gave you a little parenthetical expansion there. See, you know, don't think too simplistically about, you know, the word salvation. Right? I mean, it has a twofold, you know, it's sort of salvation now and salvation at the end of your life, right? The religious consolation for today, you know, that's the basic escapism sense of evolutionary religion. But then, you know, eventually you want these assurances of hope for immortality after death. And the mystery cults were all over that stuff. Okay. So, I mean, it gave you know, they, you know, if you give people what they want, it's amazing what they'll do in the name of what they want. I mean, what they'll do literally destructive of themselves for the sake of believing that they get what they want. Right? Yeah, and that's what the mystery cults are about. Incredible excesses that people would submit to in the name of getting that promise of salvation. And we're, you know, and even if you don't go to those excesses, I mean, that's true of all, you know, religions. I mean, people will, you know, if you promise them salvation, you know, when you join their sect, you know, say of Christianity, and they go, okay, cool, okay, I've got the promise of salvation. Now, just tell me exactly what I do. Okay, I'm supposed to think about this. How? Okay, I'll stop thinking about the way I used to think about it. I'll think about it like that now. And you want me to stand on one foot, you know, on which day? And, you know, they'll just do whatever they're told, right? Whatever rituals or whatnots, thoughts that they're supposed to assent to. If they can believe that they've got that salvation they crave.
25 Hail Marys and...
whatever. They'll just do whatever. Right?
Yep. The three mystery cults which became most popular were... 1, the Phrygian cult of Cybele and her son Attis. 2, the Egyptian cult of Osiris and his mother Isis. 3, the Iranian cult of the worship of Mithras as the savior and redeemer of sinful mankind.
Okay. Right. Well, the whole next section is devoted to Mithraism, and then they'll expand on the first two here in the remainder of this section, but, you know, let's just think about them up front here. Okay, so Cybele, that's the quote-unquote great mother. All right, that's the primary mother cult expression, right, that's in play here, you know, in Roman times and in early Christian times. You've got this mother-son thing. It's like, oh, this is sounding like this sets up for Mary and Jesus. Yes, right, of course it does. And notice what you do. You know, you invent Osiris and Isis way back mythologically as a direct extension of Adam and Eve. Osiris and Isis are just, you know, mythological Adam and Eve. And that doesn't disappear. But over time, it evolves because it needs to serve a new role. So instead of Osiris being, right, the husband, it becomes the son, right? Because you're going to use it in the mother cult modality, right? So you turn Osiris into the son instead of the husband, and play it forward that way. Right? And so, you know, you have all kinds of apparent Madonna child things, right, that are not, you know, Mary and Jesus at all. They're, you know, Isis and Osiris, or Cybele and Attis.
Right? That mother of God cult.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, but and see, so they're both Mother of God cult, but the primary one, you know, that's Cybele, you know, as opposed to Isis. Isis is just sort of a subculture of the mother cult there in Roman times. Yeah, it just further guaranteed that you were going to interpret Jesus and his mom that way. If Cybele and Attis wasn't enough, I mean, you throw in Isis and Osiris, okay, then it's a given. There's no way you're not going to interpret Mary and Jesus that way, as it becomes an evolutionary religion. All right, and the keys that we'll notice as we go forward with these mystery cults, they break into the first two is a set, and then the third. We'll see that as we go forward, what I mean by that. But let's take a look at each of the first two here.
The Phrygian and Egyptian mysteries taught that the divine son, respectively Attis and Osiris, had experienced death and had been resurrected by divine power, and further, that all who were properly initiated into the mystery and who reverently celebrated the anniversary of the god's death and resurrection would thereby become partakers of his divine nature and his immortality.
Huh, sounds kind of like John 3:16. right. Yeah.
I saw that.
Right. I mean, yeah. Like, you know, I mean, everything we're going to read, it's like, you know, all you have to do, you just take everything exactly as it was laid out. All you have to do is just change it, the names. And ta-da, you know, you've got Christianity. With all of its ideas, all of its rituals, everything, it's all prepackaged.
Kind of interesting.
Right. I mean,
it's
just an incredibly overt, crystal clear demonstration of how evolutionary religion works. Right? It's recent enough that we have lots of records and stuff, so you can see exactly how this is always played out for the last million years. You know, it's just breathtaking how unoriginal, right, most of Christianity is. You know, quite startling to the initiate, you know, who thinks he's in possession of nothing but originality. Yeah, you know, it's like almost the exact opposite. all right, yeah. So it's just, you know, of course, you know, the Melchizedek author here is purposely, you know, using words to describe this that are the way Christians describe it, just so you can see how exactly synced up it is. All right.
The Phrygian ceremonies were imposing but degrading. Their bloody festivals indicate how degraded and primitive these Levantine mysteries became. The most holy day was Black Friday, the, quote, day of blood, commemorating the self-inflicted death of Attis. After 3 days of the celebration of the sacrifice and death of Attis, the festival was turned to joy in honor of his resurrection.
Christ the Lord has risen today.
He chopped off his own
Black Friday. Right. So, you know, yeah, you've got, you know, self-inflicted death, okay? And it's not on the third day, it's after 3 days. But, okay, I mean, it's so close, it's just trivial to morph it, right? I mean, you literally have a holy week,
yeah.
Right, in the Phrygian mystery cult. You literally have a holy week. Right? You've got Black Friday. Right? I mean, you've got the whole works.
Cyber Monday.
Right? I mean, it's, yeah. But, of course, you know, like they're pointing out, you know, this, you know, how degrading, you know. I mean, you know, literally they're whipping themselves so that they can have lots of blood that they can fling on the altar of Attis. And, you know, and then, you know, one of the things that you could do is join the eunuch crew by castrating yourself, self-castrating yourself on that day. I mean, it was just a delightful orgiastic, you know, extravaganza. Okay. But, see, you know, if you just make it less coarse, right? You can bring, you know, change the names, and you've got something, you know, for Christianity.
Circumcision.
And you can go, well, you know, wouldn't it be handy if there was basically the same scheme, only it was less grotesque? Oh, yeah, let's read the next paragraph.
The rituals of the worship of Isis and Osiris were more refined and impressive than were those of the Phrygian cult. This Egyptian ritual was built around the legend of the Nile god of old, a god who died and was resurrected, which concept was derived from the observation of the annually recurring stoppage of vegetation growth, followed by the springtime restoration of all living plants. The frenzy of the observance of these mystery cults and the orgies of their ceremonials, which were supposed to lead up to the, quote, enthusiasm of the realization of divinity, were sometimes most revolting.
Okay, so it's not a massive improvement, but it is a bit of a refinement. It gives people 2 points in a line that they can extend to a third point. It's like, okay, if I go from the Phrygian Mother of God cult to the Egyptian one, I just have to take one more step of refinement, and I've got what I need for Christianity. See, so that's an important thing that it had the two. And what are you doing there again? Okay, you've got what, it was the Mother of God cult that was developed amongst the real primitive peoples. But you're going to have a refinement from the greater civilization that Egypt, injects into the whole evolutionary system. Where did a lot of the sophistication of the Hebraic religion come from, like we were just reading? It came from Egypt, right? I mean, they're that refining influence upon those primitive nomadic peoples, right, to get something a little bit more sophisticated going. Right? The thoughts of Akhenaten and Menomopi and et cetera, to bring some refinement of thought, into the process. So you see the same thing here again. And like I said, you can see an Isis Osiris little sculpture, and you'll swear you're seeing a Christian sculpture of the Madonna and Child. Mm-hmm. Right. it's just rolls right over, into Michelangelo's chisel. Okay. all right.
The cynics had no shot at competing with this.
Yeah, and you've got a similar thing with the fifth epical revelation. It's a bit like the cynics. Right?
Yeah.
You've got something that, makes this a very abstract challenge to its reader in so many ways. I mean, even in the simpler parts of the book, right? I mean, it's making a pretty strong abstract challenge. It's just going to go, right? I mean, that's not what most people on the planet. I mean, like we were reading about Melchizedek proper, Machaventa proper. I mean, the reality is vast, countless millions of people on this planet, they don't need the fifth epical revelation. They're not even ready for the fourth epical revelation yet. They don't have the third yet. They don't have trust and faith yet. Right? They need to be encouraged to establish the foundation of trust and faith. And then we can evolve it forward into faith and trust, right? From trust and faith, we can make trust the foundational element that liberates faith. It doesn't have to be a static foundational element anymore. It can be liberated and rest upon the foundation of trust and be living faith. Set faith free to be living for the first time. And then once you have living faith, now you can start talking about the fourth epical revelation of love and service. And having established that, okay, now we can start by bringing in some philosophy and improving your ideas about the Universal Father and, maybe even talk about the Trinity Infinite or something, right? But, until then, when you don't even have faith as a static, basically static foundational element, so that trust is not even possible, what do you have? You've got nothing, right? I mean, if trust is not possible, the spiritual essence of trust is not possible. Genuine hope is not possible. All you've got is wishful thinking as a substitute. I mean, you don't have anything, really. Right? So, so many people, what they need, right, is the third epical revelation, that simple message, by faith alone, right, does it begin. Genuine faith. Set aside foolish, superstitious belief, you know, and wishful thinking, you know, and recognize your God-given super conscious fact, make it a conscious fact, genuine faith. Establish that. And now you're on the road forward. Now you're consciously real for the first time, instead of just by grace super consciously real. Right? You know, while you flounder around as, you know, a mere temporal actuality, right? And wonder why everything seems like quicksand. Right?
And you're vainly hoping.
Yeah, yeah, you'll be vainly hoping for the future. You'll be regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future.
Is there a philosophical difference between then what you're saying is to choose to be this way, choose to do live in a faithful way, but it seems like what you're implying is that all of us are waiting for someone to tell us to or to choose us to be that way.
Yeah, it's a huge problem because, okay, so he wants me to be have genuine faith. Well, let me go to the dictionary and figure out what the word faith... Oh, the word faith is not in the dictionary in any genuine sense. That's a false definition in the dictionary. It says faith is credulous belief. No, genuine faith has nothing to do with belief. Nothing. And it's certainly not credulous belief.
Right.
I mean, evolutionary religion, you know, is intellectual assent, credulity, and established authority. Real religion is none of those things. Right, it's faith, trust, and genuine assurance. Right. These are unknowns. These are unknowns. I mean, you know, you get a little close to genuine faith with Paul, but that's not in the dictionary. You know, that's not the way people use it in common parlance. It's not even the way religionists use it in general. You know, they say I'm a person of faith. They mean I'm a person of credulous belief. Right. You know, they don't face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. They don't. They ignore facts. Right. And believe credulously. That's not going to get us anywhere. We're not in the sheltered bay anymore. Hey, you're not going to sail the high seas with credulous belief. We're all going to drown. You got to have something better than credulous belief on the high seas. It seems to work. You know, in the lagoon, in the blue lagoon, but that's an illusion. Right? Right? God expects you to grow up, you know, like it says up there. And you start out as a child, but you know, you have to become an adult of God eventually. Right? That can sail the high seas. Okay, now back to here. So that refinement that the Egyptian, you know, based Mother of God cult brings in. You know, notice the ideas like enthusiasm, quote unquote. You know, I'm feeling the spirit, right? You know, I'm in-godded, right? The enthusiasm, literally. Mm-hmm. You know, all that, you know, which, you know, the moment you start thinking that, you know, remember what happens naturally to your animal origin mind in that mode. That's you go fetishistic. Right, you know, you're going to be thinking in terms of being possessed,
snake.
You know, and you know, and it becomes a fetishism, right? And you're going to think of Jesus as a fetish, right? Instead of Jesus / the man, right? Right? He's not going to Jesus. You know, the first section title of the last paper: Jesus / the man.
Yes.
Right. Right, you know, he doesn't. He's of no use to you as an example if he's a fetish, if he's a magical fetish thing. Right, you're not a magical fetish thing unless you start thinking you are. Right, okay, then maybe you think that's relevant to you, but you're not. Right, you're immortal. Right, Jesus the mortal has got something to offer you. Not Jesus the fetish man. Right. Yeah, so all of this stuff, you know, it all just happens naturally. You don't even recognize you're turning Jesus into a fetish, but you will the moment you start thinking in the kind of the old school way of you know, it's one thing to be inspired, right, kind of in a metaphoric sense, but if you start thinking literally, you know, I've been possessed, right, you know, and now I'm just, you know, a puppet, you know, by what's possessing me. Okay, let's look at the cult of Mithras here.
Section 5, the cult of Mithras. The Phrygian and Egyptian mysteries eventually gave way before the greatest of all the mystery cults, the worship of Mithras. The Mithraic cult made its appeal to a wide range of human nature and gradually supplanted both of its predecessors. Mithraism spread over the Roman Empire through the propagandizing of Roman legions recruited in Levant, where this religion was the vogue, for they carried this belief wherever they went. And this new religious ritual was a great improvement over the earlier mystery cults.
Okay, so you notice, you know, you can see right up front, with Mithraism, you don't have this kind of simplistic mother, son, death, resurrection modality thing playing out. It's got other elements. It's, you know, it's, as we'll see here, it's what gives you the rest of the story to Christianity as it forms. And it's going to, you know, bring in all of those concepts from India and through Zoroastrian. So, you know, it's going to bring in more of that definitive dual spiritism concept, right, of light and the darkness. But it's, you know, in its initial form, it's still got the whole ritualistic grotto, you know, whatnot going on. But that's where Christianity started out too, right, in the grottos. They didn't have big cathedrals to begin with. They started out in the grottos because they're just morphing all this stuff, you know, to the next evolutionary step. All right, and when they say, you know, it gradually supplanted both of its predecessors, right? I mean, so as you move forward from, you know, the times of Jesus, when we move into the second and the third centuries, right, this is what you should be visualizing here. Right? As you move into the second and third centuries, you're you know, like the great mother thing, you know, with Sibylle. Okay, that's fading to a degree, and Mithraism is rising. So you have this tipping, right, from one to the other that's going on. So that by the time you get to the fourth century and you're going to start sort of officially codifying Christianity, you know, the concepts of Mithraism are going to be the dominant predicate for that codification, and the God the Mother cult issues will be secondary. And so that's why Christianity formed that way, right? We'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. But that's the important thing to visualize. So they're just going to take us forward through the second, third, into the fourth centuries with this, you know, picture. That's what's happened. You know, that's the span of time over which what they're talking about is happening. Okay.
The cult of Mithras arose in Iran and long persisted in its homeland, despite the militant opposition of the followers of Zoroaster. But by the time Mithraism reached Rome, it had become greatly improved by the absorption of many of Zoroaster's teachings. It was chiefly through the Mithraic cult that Zoroaster's religion exerted an influence upon later appearing Christianity.
And so this, I mean, this is huge. You know, if you go way back to the, you know, not very well understood misty origins of Mithraism in India, okay, I mean, you're not finding what was in Rome only way back then. I mean, it's, you know, it's very different. It sort of radically morphs by the time it gets into the budding Christian context and starts to, you know, an interplay with budding Christianity. Okay, so like they're trying to emphasize there. It's basically ought to be called something different. If you call what was there to begin with Mithraism, you really should kind of call this something else. But, you know, the only thing in common is you're still, you know, the main character in the play is Mithras. Okay, so you're still calling it Mithraism, but it's like Neo-Mithraism or something, right? I mean, it's a significantly morphed phenomenon from how it started. And like I said, it's like they're saying there, it's bringing in a lot of those kind of key concepts that Zoroaster was working with. And that's going to be advantageous. It's going to play right into making it all the more palatable for the Roman people and the early Christians to take, you know, to synchronize with it and morph it a step forward. Okay. Without that Zoroastrian morphing, okay, there would have been a dissonance, you know, that there wasn't. You know. So it was easy for them to synchronize with it now once it had morphed.
The Mithraic cult portrayed a militant god taking origin in a great rock, engaging in valiant exploits, and causing water to gush forth from a rock struck with his arrows. There was a flood from which one man escaped in a specially built boat, and a last supper which Mithras celebrated with the sun god before he ascended into the heavens. This sun god, or Sol Invictus, was a degeneration of the Ahura Mazda deity concept of Zoroastrianism. Mithras was conceived as a surviving champion of the sun god in his struggle with the god of darkness. And in recognition of his slaying the mythical sacred bull, Mithras was made immortal, being exalted to the station of intercessor for the human race among the gods on high.
Jesus as the intercessor. Yeah. You know, it's like, Jesus never taught that. Why did they? Oh, that's how it got in there. Right. Jesus was trying to, you know, get the priests out from in between you and God. You know, okay, to the degree to which he succeeded in that, you know, they stuck Jesus in between. It's like, no. Right. Right. You know, again, that so it becomes Jesusism, just like it's Mithraism. You know, Mithraism. Okay, so, you know, you've got all of this stuff, you know, that's just primed, you know. Gee, you know, the sun god, you suppose that works on Sunday? Right? You know, and then, of course, with the Romans, there's Sol Invictus, you know, the invincible sun, right? How that, you know, with their whole, you know, warrior culture, and whatever, if you want to call it, or at least empire-building culture, all that, the invincible Romans, it all feeds into that exaltation of the establishment and the extending of the empire outward, and, you know, the strength of the sun. All right, so it's got all of those points of contact immediately for the Romans, and then, of course, what they're obviously pointing out is just how many things, you know, roll last right supper. Into Christianity. Right? There's a Last Supper, you know, right? The whole bit of, you know, they very much had the bread and the wine, you know, celebration. All that is all there, you know, the intercessor concept and ascending into heaven having him being born up out of the earth. I mean, Jesus is, you know, born a babe in Bethlehem. See, all that stuff basically just fits.
Was there a Mithras?
Probably.
Was it just a
mystery? Yeah, I mean, right. See, like I said, I mean, it goes back into pretty misty territory if you try to take it back. I mean, there's just so little records.
Rhino somewhere that came out of a rock.
You know?
Well, have you seen images of Sol Invictus and then images of Attis?
Because mm-hmm.
They look exactly the same, and they look exactly like the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah. right. There's all those sorts of things, right? Too. Yeah, the common mythological symbolization schemes, and yeah, I mean, yeah. So you know, you can bring Egypt in, and see, all this stuff can come together. Now, of course, you know, we all know the main reason that all this stuff can eventually sort of come together. What does it have? Is a general essence in common? It all has some little flavoring by the Andites. Mm. Right? You know, the Andite civilization, you know, is what's feeding a foundational commonality. And it's like, so when people come together, it's like, well, you know, we aren't that different. We can kind of come together and stand on the same thing. I mean, you know, there's a genetic predicate, right? That, you know, it's the Andites that produce that potential for harmonizing things by laying out, you know, even if it's subtle, a little bit of a foundation of conception in the way they thought about things and the way they influenced the peoples that they conquered and et cetera. It's, you know, so many answers to the mysteries of how things came to be. You know, it's the answer is the Andites.
Hard to fault Abner. He was so outmatched.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, how is, you know, little simplistic purist Abner going to, you know, compete with this? This is, like I said, the Mithraic cults, you know, had developed, you know, over 40,000 years, basically, right, all that time, you know, into this elaborate complexity. You know, 30,000 years, whatever you want to say. Had a long time to have develop all kinds of very sharp resonance with, you know, the animal natural nature of us. Right? I mean, it knew all and knows all our buttons. You know, it knows how to get our attention and keep our attention. And because it's a product of a lot of evolution. Right? Yeah. Right, so just some new fangled thing that you construct is just not going to remotely have that kind of resonance. All right, see anything else there? They're mentioning the light darkness thing, like we said. All you have to do, you know, again, is just you take the literalness of goring bowls and stuff out of the ceremonies. You know, you clean it up like that, and you've got something that the Christians can do in their grotto.
The adherents of this cult worshipped in caves and other secret places, chanting hymns, mumbling magic, eating the flesh of the sacrificial animals, and drinking the blood. Three times a day they worshipped, with special weekly ceremonies on the day of the sun god, and with the most elaborate observance of all on the annual festival of Mithras, December 25th. It was believed that the partaking of the sacrament ensured eternal life, the immediate passing after death to the bosom of Mithras, there to tarry in bliss until the judgment day. On the judgment day, the Mithraic keys of heaven would unlock the gates of paradise for the reception of the faithful, whereupon all the unbaptized of the living and the dead would be annihilated upon the return of Mithras to earth. It was taught that when a man died, he went before Mithras for judgment, and that at the end of the world, Mithras would summon all the dead from their graves to face the last judgment. The wicked would be destroyed by fire, and the righteous would reign with Mithras forever.
And he shall reign forever. Right.
So much of this.
Right.
The whole
thing.
How easy it was.
Right, so you have up, right, it's just so easy to just swap the names, right? See, I mean, so up front you've got, you know, some of these issues, you know, like literally, you know, worshiping on Sunday. You know, like I said, you know, Caesar is there. And then, of course, the winter solstice, which is on December 25th in the Julian calendar. All right, and you know, why do you have him, Mithras, being born on that day? Because it takes 9 months, so you go back 9 months. When was Mithras conceived? Vernal equinox, mm-hmm. Right? Which is New Year's Day, right? So see, it all just makes complete sense. You know, you have the conception at the beginning of the year, and 9 months later he's born, right? And remember, by the time you get to the fourth century and are codifying Christianity, the other thing that you're doing there in the fourth century is, you know, you want to really push the real Jesus scheme forward to people. But after all that time, by the time you get to the fourth century, most Christians, so-called Christians, followers of, did not any longer believe that Jesus was ever a man. Right? I mean, he'd already, you know, just that short span of time, he had already morphed into just kind of a mystical spirit notion. Okay. And that's, you know, so the founders of the church there in the fourth century said, you know, good grief, we need to celebrate Jesus' birth again to remind everyone, you know, that he was actually born a babe in Bethlehem and all that, because, you know, they're just off in spiritual woo land here now. You know, so they initiate the feast day of the Nativity. Well, by the fourth century, no one could remember exactly when Jesus was born. It wasn't recorded or anything. You know, they made their best guess of what year and stuff. What day and month, you know, no one had a clue. All right, so you just go with the mode, it fits naturally. It's like, well, do the same thing. He's born on New Year's Day. I mean, he's conceived on New Year's Day, and he's born 9 months later on winter solstice. Yeah, just as simple as that. Yeah. And so you have the feast day of the Nativity on the winter solstice on December 25th. All of that, you know, and coincidentally, myth, you know, the whole Mithraic notion had the same scheme. So, right.
The resurrection of all the sleeping survivors.
Right. And that part.
There's some truth there.
Right, yeah. So like I said, so there's that part. And then there's the, you know, the eschatological sort of stuff. And if you ever wondered, why was it that there became, you know, these popular, quote-unquote, dime store novels sort of there in the wake of Jesus? There was a whole favorite literature that developed up, this apocalyptic literature. Now, all kinds of different stories, one of which is the Apocalypse of John, and the Apocalypse of Peter, and those, and many, many, many others. Those were all written. They were the favorites, you know, stories that everyone was buying, you know, in the dime store, quote unquote. It's because you're morphing this fascination in Mithraism with all of that stuff, you know, into a Christian modality, and so all kinds of stories were being written. So all of that stuff that's really not so much biblical, except for what kind of eventually got turned around and incorporated into the Bible, like with the book of Revelation, say, you know, or reworking, you know, what's in Matthew and Mark and stuff. That's where it came from. Again, it's Mithraism that sort of was fueling that interest in the second coming and all that sort of stuff. And of course, you know, you could, it's like, oh, wait, didn't Jesus say something about that? And right, and so you can misremember what he said, you know, and morph it into exactly what, you know, the whole Mithraic notion was, and, you know, and forward you go. So it, you know, it's just from beginning to end, you know, from birth to second coming, it's all just a reworking in so many ways in terms of the basic notions and all the rituals that go with it, what day you worship on, you know, instead of worshiping on the Sabbath, you know, yeah, you worship on Sunday, etc. And you make Sunday the Sabbath instead of the old school.
Dispensational resurrection, I mean, that's...
yeah.
So you can see how, when I first read this, I was saying to myself, geez, you know, is Christianity real? I was like, it sounds so much like it. I mean, was that story really real? What was the real story of Jesus?
Right.
Because I hadn't gotten to the Jesus part yet.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
Whoa.
And it should remind you again, when you're reading part four, be on your guard. It's oh so easy to not really hear what's there.
Right.
Right? And to hear what you've always heard. You know, to not notice, oh, wait a minute, what they're saying there is actually quite different. But, you know, many readers go decades and never notice that, right? You know, the things that are very different, actually, than the story you're used to. It's just like it was for the people who wrote the New Testament. You know, it was so easy for them to just be in their cultural scheme and kind of unconsciously, if not consciously, morph things. You'll do the same thing as you're reading the book. You got to be really on your guard not to put new wine in old wineskins. It's what you naturally do. It's not because you're flawed or anything. It's just the way God made you. Right? That's the way you'll do it. You have to be unnatural to a significant degree to really resonate with the revelation as intended. And not to just recast it in your same false sphere where you've been living with everything forever.
Well, the reception of the faithful.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of interesting.
Yes, it is. Yeah. You know, and it just, you know, the degree to which you, you know, being raised as a Christian, you know, you felt that the things that they were telling you had to be true because they were so precise and sophisticated. Yeah, see, no. Like I said, he has all that time for to develop that precision and sophistication in Mithraism. Right? And then you just rolled it over into Christianity. See, it's not a hallmark of its truth. It's a hallmark of its age. Every religious notion, you know, just builds more wheels within wheels as time goes by. Like we were reading about the evolution of religion. They all become very, very precise and sophisticated, so much so that only a professional can keep track of all the details, and that's why you need a priesthood, right? Because, I mean, only they know exactly, you know, all the minutiae of, I mean, this super complicated tax code thing called their theology. Yeah, that's just the way we are. And we take everything, and the natural tendency is to go to ever more opaque complexity. Right? It's an unnatural thing to think in the Occam's razor fashion.
So how's Christianity ever going to evolve out of that?
Or what's going to evolve out of Christianity?
Yeah. They have to die first, what?
Or what will evolve out of Christianity?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, a little reminder, you know, like we said, I mean, you've got this whole issue of, you know, you can think about the fifth epical revelation relative to the main evolutionary stream, like, say, one of the things that's in there, Christianity. But, okay, you need to face a lot of facts about that. You can't have any fanciful illusions how, oh, this is going to be easy. It's like, no, it's not. I mean, it's super complicated to have something that can actually, you know, dot as many I's and cross as many T's as that long evolutionary product dots and crosses, okay? And then on top of that, remember when we were reading The Evolution of Religion, you know, unlike what people have always thought, like, say, someone like Akhenaten, you know, you don't just directly engage the religious nucleus in the culture, the cult in the culture. You have to feed it into the moray system, right? And then having a modified moray system, that moray system can now can coalesce a new cult nucleus out of it. That's where this, you know, step forward thing comes from. So if you're going to engage the main evolutionary stream, you've got to know all of that, the physics of that, and be very patient. You know, you're not, it's not going to happen in your lifetime. You're starting something that, you know, generations down the road might begin to, you know, impact things. If that's not your cup of tea, well, there's good news. There's a parallel stream. You can just step out of that main evolutionary stream and, you know, and be like the Kenites were, you know, in contrast to Abraham and crew, right? Set up that, become part of that parallel stream that doesn't need to go through all this complicated long-term evolutionary process. You can just choose this day to erase all of that gibberish in your head and start completely fresh. No long span of time is essentially required. And, you can take control of your animal origin subject evolution phenomenon, and you can choose to reframe it and be different tomorrow. Right? But the world out there is not going to be different tomorrow. It takes a long time to be different. Right? And if you try to make it different tomorrow, that's called revolution, and that's
right. Bad.
As opposed to revelation.
Right. Right. But yeah, inside you can turn it on a dime, and if you've taken delight in cultivating enough that you can, you know, have some self-control, okay, you can get a whole, you know, you can rotate the lower domain too, you know, in a relatively short time. But yeah, so you've got to, you know, you got to choose. If you feel your job is to engage the main evolutionary stream and influence it, okay, you got to learn the physics of all that, understand how that works, the time scales involved, the complexities involved. It's a huge problem. Right. Very complicated thing.
And complex.
What?
And complex.
Yes. Well. Yeah, it is. It's
so
just,
then how does a parallel stream like the Kenites then affect change over time?
I always bring up that because the third epical revelation was also an emergency one, just like this one. So there's a lot of parallels. Machaventus, not only ministered to the main evolutionary stream because he was trying to, you know, work towards having something for Jesus to come into, right? But he also made a point of establishing a parallel stream. And out of that parallel stream, you can eventually have a Moses, right? That can be, you can step out of that parallel stream into the main evolutionary stream as a leader, right? That's what that parallel stream really serves, you know, besides just what it gives you, you know, in and of yourself, you know, some comfort and a greater relationship with the cosmos. But out of that stream can come leadership material, and you need that little, at most 1%, right, to come out of that parallel philosophically integrous stream into the ignorance of the main evolutionary stream and be a leader there. Very important for civilization to work. I mean, one of the main reasons why the main evolutionary stream is in an emergency state that gives you a fifth epical revelation here on the verge of a collapse of civilization is there's no parallel stream anymore out of which any leader can come, really.
This is trying to make one.
This is trying to give the opportunity for that.
That's right.
Right? Right? I mean, the common man doesn't need to know all of these complexities, but a leader needs to have a big picture.
Right.
Right? I mean, your job as a leader is not to teach people, you know, all the minutiae of total deity, right? But you have that bigger picture, you know, so that you have the objectivity, the wisdom, and the insight, and the foresight to lead, to know how to get people to follow, because they need to be led. Right? They can't lead themselves. We're not in the age of light and life where everyone is a leader, basically, you know. And we're a long ways away from that. All right, let's keep rolling here so we can finish this up.
At first, it was a religion only for men, and there were seven different orders into which believers could be successively initiated. Later on, the wives and daughters of believers were admitted to the temples of the Great Mother, which adjoined the Mithraic temples. The women's cult was a mixture of Mithraic ritual and the ceremonies of the Phrygian cult of Cybele, the mother of Attis.
Right. So this final little footnote paragraph here for the evening allows you to kind of clearly see, when all is said and done, you know, how Christianity got started. Because, you know, literally, Christianity is taking over that place of worship there, central place of worship, you know, and bringing the adjoining temples together, the Mithraic temple and the Great Mother temple, merging them into one temple. And, you can see they're telling you how kind of practically that was possible to bring those together and morph it forward into Christianity, into Roman Catholicism specifically, right? Because the Mother of God cult had already adopted the basic ritualistic forms of Mithraism. So it had that common ritualistic foundation. That, bringing that together, of course, it's not going to just completely melt together. There's a fundamental tension there. There were two temples to begin with. Okay, there's a separation, there's a tension. And that tension is still there today in Roman Catholicism. You have two kind of basic ideologies there in Roman Catholicism. On the one hand, you have sort of the main structural picture, which is what Mithraism really morphed into, and that's the Christology part of Roman Catholicism. But there's a secondary ology, right? There's Mariology, right, in Roman Catholicism. You know, and that tension is there. Pope John Paul II was very much a Marian pope. Right? He had a lot of affinity to the Mariology side. There's always been this tension in the church when people start to really kind of essentially getting caught up in the old Mother of God cult, right? to the exclusion of everything else, you know, forget about Universal Father and even Jesus, right? And you just get all wrapped up in the Mother of God cult again. And it's like, well, wait a minute, guys, you know, can't lose sight of Jesus. You know, of course, they don't really say that. You can't lose sight of Christ. Right? It's not Jesusology, it's Christology. And it's, you know, that concept of Christ, like we just read, I mean, that is all, like we just read, very much the concept of Mithras. And that's where you get the Christ instead of just the Jesus. So that's, you know, that's how it all got put together. And it's an extremely sophisticated, clever evolutionary product. It's satisfying a lot of basic desires and needs. Don't underestimate how much inertia is there. You know, you're not going to trivially brush that aside and replace it with a wrench in religion or something. It's not going to happen. That's absurd to think that. Right? And then, you know, there comes the challenge. It's like, well, and there's so much precision in this book. I mean, it's going to be at odds at a million points of their precision. You know, don't think that they're imprecise. They're not. They're very, there's all kinds of precision. Right? You're going to have infinite points of conflict. Right?
Maybe you can place the mother up. The mother god.
Yeah, right. And then, of course, yeah, I mean...
Well, we'll get into a fetishism of the mother god.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's a big problem, you know. It, you know, you see God the Mother in your ranch, but it's like, oh, yeah, we know about that. It's like, no, you don't. No. Heavens, no. But, you know, it's, you know, if you're going to engage the main evolutionary stream... you know, you need to go basically back into Jesus's mode. I mean, Jesus didn't say, write down what I said and go out there and hit people over the head with what you've written. Right? What does the final paper of the book tell you to do? Does it tell you to go out with a book? Or does it tell you to go out with the faith of Jesus?
Right.
Right? If you're going to make an impact in that main evolutionary stream, right, this may be, your answer book may have spun you up. Okay, but you now need to literally take a hold of the exact same faith, genuine faith that Jesus had. And you can do that because he's not a fetish. He's a man. You can do that. Right? You can have this identical faith, real faith, living faith. And you can go out and you can have a profound impact on your fellow man. Right? But you got to go out there with an inner life. Not with an outer life, especially an outer life with all these words and complexity, and it's like, you know, it's, you know, you're going to get, it's just going to get totally muddled up if you try to do that. If you want to give them something pure and beneficial, try the faith of Jesus. Yeah, but then that brings us back around. It's like, well, what if I really like all of the complexity here? Like how it allows me to really clear up all the problems with fundamental physics, you know, or the evolution of the earth, or, yeah, there's a parallel stream. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's not the main evolutionary stream. This is answering questions for the parallel stream, not the main evolutionary stream, science or otherwise. It's not looking for these answers. There's no astronomer that's looking for an explanation of the curious redshifts of galaxies where the answer is, well, that's associate transcendental master force organizers. There is no astronomer that is going to accept that answer. That is the answer. Okay?
Answers are
around. Or any of these other things. Right? You know, not to mention kind of on the other side, you know, it's like, well, I got to find that Buddhist out there that's waiting for me to tell him that his thoughts are grotesque.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, seriously, okay, there is no Buddhist that's waiting for you to tell him that. That's what the book says.
Right? Well, I think everybody wants to know that they're, you know, a son of God, or that they have.
They're going to say that all our thoughts are
good.
Right.
Real truth.
Say something that someone of real faith can say. Don't quote words. You know, was Jesus a minor bird? No, he was a man of living faith, right? And he said what living faith says, right? If you have a real spiritual inner life, you have an upper domain, you don't have to form fruits. The fruits are automatic, mm-hmm. right? You know you don't have a real inner life if you're having to figure out how to build fruits. That's proof that, yeah, you don't get it. So, I mean, all of this is in play. I mean, it's important to really kind of take the time to start spinning this up, because, you know, we're about to read papers 99 to 103. This is where you start to really challenge yourself with these issues. What is this book about? What is it challenging? What are its limitations in the world? What are its limitations in me? I mean, how much can I expect to even take a hold of this stuff? I mean, is it answering like millions of questions I'm not even asking yet? It's answering questions that only the most reflective mind after centuries recognized as a question. You know, have you reworked through all that so that you're at that same question point? Probably not. You can get there, but you're not going to do it tomorrow. You got a lot of work to do to get up to the point where you can recognize what it is that they're addressing in a lot of parts of the book. Otherwise, you're just going to stick the wine in old wineskins. You're going to interpret it all falsely. It's not going to get you anywhere. Okay, well, let's wrap it up there for the evening. We'll finish up this paper next Friday, and then be ready for paper 99. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.